Welcome along, everybody, and it's lovely to see some new folks. And this morning's session is the second in a new series on creation, and it's founded on the principle of a verse in Romans that it says the invisible things of God are clearly seen by the things that are made. And so we're going to explore different aspects of the Genesis 1 account. And as we do so, we're going to be thinking about what can we learn about God as we look into these passages. So I'd like you to turn to Genesis chapter 1, please. And we're just going to read verses 2 to 5, and I'd like to invite somebody to read verses 2 to 5 for us, please.
The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, and it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day.
Thanks. I didn't check that one. It's very dark, you see. Can you switch the lights off, Richard, for us? They're just behind you. Thanks. It's probably quite fitting because the passage says things were very dark. And it begins in the earth, and just occasionally, you know, it's nice to hear some of the Hebrew words. I don't pronounce them well, but this Eretz, I think, and correct me if it's not right, was without form. And this idea of without form, it's like it's like a waste. It's like it's nothing there in the sense of you know, order, and things are just a wilderness. It's an empty place without any beauty. So the image over here is just a very, very faint little globe that's hard to see because it's very dark. But that's kind of what it was. That's how the earth got underway. But there's another little bit that comes into that, and it says, "And darkness was upon the face of the deep." Now, with the evolutionary paradigm of origins of the universe, they say, you know, that the earth formed as a dry, molten, sort of barren wasteland. But the Bible says, no, it was without form, but it was covered in deep water from the outset. Very interesting and opposite story. And the word for deep there means, you know, not just a little shallow stream or a little bit of water. We're talking about depths of oceans covering this amazing beginning of the earth. So it's very dark. You can't see a lot. And then the next bit says, "And the Spirit." This is the Hebrew word ruach. And we're not talking about just breath there, because in the sense of wind, because the atmosphere wasn't created at that time. It's definitely referring to the person of God, his Spirit. And what it does draw our attention to is right at the outset, there was intelligent, directed design underpinning the formation of the earth. There's not a hint of billions of years of randomness and chance and undesigned sort of natural processes at work. And the Spirit moved. Spirit of God moved intentionally with all the wisdom, with all the power, with all the capacity of God moving upon the face of the waters. And I don't know if you can see the little, I don't know what you call that, is a GIF or something, a little... Yeah, and you can see it sort of moving. I thought that kind of just illustrated something, because where the scriptures say the Spirit of God moved, it's a little bit, it's the same word that's mentioned in Deuteronomy where a bird flutters or broods over its young, you know? And it's this caring, contemplative sort of movement of God's, the Spirit of God, as he's intentionally planning the next step. You know, he's not waiting around for billions of years for something to accidentally happen. It's actually a bit like an architect will brood, if you like, over the constraints of the property of the owner who's given financial restraints, but also given parameters for the design and the structure of your building. You know, it's very much a bit like that. And again, we've got the waters mentioned. Incredibly important aspect, the waters. And today's session is going to involve a little bit of chemistry. And anyone who's, you know, happens to have a bit of a qualification in chemistry is welcome to contribute. So that's kind of the introduction bit. Now, it's very dark. It says darkness, so it's got nothing. But if you think about it, God's there, water's there, the earth's there, and what's needed next is this amazing thing called light. And it says, and God said, let there be light. And guess what? When God speaks, watch out. When God, this is the first mention of God said something. And I'm going to unpack just what light is shortly, and it's pretty sobering stuff. And so when we think about God's word, when God speaks, it's no joke. Take it seriously. And in this case, he said, let there be light. Now the question is, what sort of light was it? Because the sun and the stars weren't created until day four. So that's a pretty good question. The Hebrew word is or, which means illumination or light. So what sort of light was it? Any thoughts?
I think it was an illuminating light. One that allowed, you know, light. You could see the form. It was no longer in darkness. It pushed the darkness away in it.
Yep. Thanks, Shane.
Something to do with the glory of God, like in Revelation, it talks yeah. about there'll come a day when the sun and the moon will flee as well, so
yes.
the land will be the light.
Yeah, and Ian hasn't seen the next little bit, but
I could just point out too that God dwells in light.
Yeah.
And as you know, the electromagnetic spectrum is really big, but there's only
yeah.
a slice of it. That's
We're going to come to that. Yep.
So God brings
yep.
light is already there.
Yep.
God dwells in light, but he brings it into the visible spectrum.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
And we're going to come to that, Chris. Back to, though, this the what was the light? I think it's reasonable to assume that it was the glory of God. Because, as Ian has mentioned, in Revelation there, it says, and the city had no need, this is in the New Jerusalem, no need of the sun, neither of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten it. And if you're a note taker and you want to look up a really juicy verse, check out, it's a bit dark for me to see, Isaiah 60 verses 19 to 20. That's a really nice companion passage. Isaiah 60, 9 to 10. So God says, let there be light. And there was light. And as Chris has alluded to, it's an amazing phenomena. Let's try and unpack it now. The next bit that God says, and God saw the light, and he says that it was good. This is the first of six times that God affirms the goodness of what he's making. It's very interesting that he doesn't say the firmament when he creates the firmament in our next session. He doesn't say, there's no mention of that being said to be good. And there's some interesting debate as to why that might be. But when he says, let there be light, and there was light, and he saw the light, and it was good. It's good light. But what is this light? And as Chris realizes, it's phenomenal stuff. So I just want to spend a little bit of time unpacking what light is, because we do so easily skip over appreciating how glorious, how wise and powerful God is. So let's unpack it. So this is the light spectrum that was mentioned earlier. It goes from cosmic rays, as far as we're aware, all the way down to these very broad band electromagnetic waves. Light, strictly speaking, as Chris mentioned, it's called, in scientific terms or physics terms, electromagnetic radiation. And it goes in waves, and I just have to believe this stuff. I can't prove it to you today, I'm sorry. It's so tiny, but evidently there are these fluctuations, electrical and magnetic fluctuations. And believe it or not, it says that these electromagnetic fields transport energy in the form of this thing called photons. Now, photons, guess what they are? They're massless, so they've got no actual atomic weight. They're subatomic particles. Now, if you thought atoms were pretty small, these are smaller, way smaller. So when he said, let there be light, we're dealing with the real invisible stuff. And just so that you really get wowed, these things travel awfully fast. So if you're one of these photons, and if you wanted to be a photon for a day, you would travel at the speed of light, which is around about just slightly under 300,000 kilometers, not per hour, but per second. One, shkapum, two, shkapum. Actually, it's more than a shkapum. It's way faster. Which, I got my calculator out, is 1.08 billion kilometers per hour, if you do 60 by 60 times the 300,000. 1.08 billion kilometers per hour. And you thought you were speeding when you were doing, you know, 60 on the way to the meeting here. You imagine going at 1.08 billion kilometers per hour. Now, when God said light, it wasn't just that, you know, we just take it off, light, you know. No, it's a phenomenal thing. And at this end of the spectrum, the wavelengths, which are the distance between the peaks of each of the waves, are incredibly, incredibly small. And down this end, broadcast band waves, they can be thousands of kilometers between the troughs and the peaks. Thousands of kilometers. One website said the width of Jupiter, you know, could be one bandwidth. But down this end, they're incredibly small. But let's just think about how small for a second. So, we're familiar with a thing called a millimeter. And if you're not, or for the kids at the back, this is a meter ruler, which you've probably seen at school. And 1 meter can be divided into millimeters, and there's 1,000 of them. 1,000 little tiny millimeters. They're about the width of your fingernail. So just lift your finger up, go, oh yeah, that's about a millimeter. That's the fingernail, not the finger. So there's 1,000 of those little things make up one of these. Well, that's a millimeter. But look, this is where the visible light spectrum is. It's not with millimeter wavelengths. It's not even with micrometer wavelengths. A micrometer would be like taking one of these little tiny millimeters and then shkapumming it by another 1,000 into another 1,000 equal bits. So you try and divide your fingernail width into 1,000 bits now. Go on, off you go. Get your nail clippers. Split your nail up to 1,000 bits. So that's 1 micrometer. Okay, so a micrometer is there. But the wavelength, visible wavelength, is not in that zone. It's in between the micrometers and the next one, which is called a nanometer. And a nanometer is like taking one of those micrometers and then shkapumming it again 1,000 times. We're talking about some pretty amazing stuff here. So visible light spectrum, which just happens to look a bit like this, sits approximately between 400 to 700 nanometer wavelengths in the electromagnetic light spectrum. And you go, oh yeah, like, when I was looking at this, I'm going, that's incredible. How could these little wavelength things just happen by chance, by some undirected natural materialistic process? It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. How do you account for the natural origin of these things? I don't believe you can. And so within this very narrow bandwidth, we have this amazing reality of the visible light spectrum, which our eyes are able to pick up on and enable us to see. So the point is, what do we learn about God from this? Because if the invisible things of Him are clearly seen by the things that are made, He's made light, what can we learn about Him? Well, I think this, first of all, light declares God's knowledge of physics and His creative power. Now, we ooh and ah people like Einstein and Newton and, you know, these scientists, and we acknowledge they do deserve honour for what they've done. But their knowledge of physics pales away into insignificance, like a candle would up against the blazing heat of sun at noonday, compared to God's incredible knowledge of wisdom and physics. And what we see is God's incredible creative power. He doesn't just have a light spectrum that's the same waves, you know. He's got cosmic waves, short waves, gamma waves, X waves, ultraviolet and infrared span each end of the visible light spectrum. Microwaves from your kitchen, radio waves, radar, broadband, long waves. It's incredible, the diversity. But what it makes me think about is that God sees way more than we do. We can only see into this zone. We can develop technology that enables us to pick up on the other things, like you tune your radio in, but you can't see those. So whoever made this light must have an amazing intellectual creative capacity. It's like, wow. The scriptures do say God is light, but we don't worship Him as the sun or anything dumb like that. The passage God is light is really a declaration of His majesty and glory. He's not a light, but He manifests radiant glory because He is holy and who He is. Now I'd like us to look up a passage in Job. It's Job chapter 9. And I'd love someone to read that out for us, because it's, we might even look at it from a couple of passages, different versions, but it's a very interesting revelation from Job. And Job, they reckon, could have been one of the earliest sort of writers of contributing to the biblical narrative. So Job chapter 9 and verse 10. Anyone like to do that for us?
He does great things past finding out, yes, wonders without number.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Someone else like to read that, perhaps at the back? This chap here, do you want to give it?
Yes.
Thanks.
Who does great things, unfathomable and wondrous works without number.
Yeah. That's amazing, isn't it? Unfathomable. It just captures something of the capacity of God. And Job perceived that way back in his day. All right, so let's now shine some light on water, because water comes up in this account in Genesis. There's a lot of it. And again, we can take it so much for granted. You know this stuff here? You know, you go turn on the tap and it just comes gushing out and you go, you know, we take it for granted. Cheers. And it's clear. It's generally odorless, hopefully odorless, colorless, you know. It's this amazing thing. We just glug it down and, yep, on with the next day, and we just complain about the rain. But if you didn't have rain, you wouldn't have any of that. But what is this stuff called water? You know, how does it talk about God? What do we learn about God through looking at water? So let's unpack it. And again, if anyone's got a master's degree in chemistry, you're very welcome to contribute or tell me if I'm wrong. So it's called a molecular compound. Okay, it's in, and it's made up of these two elements. Okay, hydrogen and oxygen. So it's a molecular compound. It's more than one. It's invisible, non-metallic, but they're gas elements because hydrogen and oxygen are gas elements, you see, at normal temperature and pressure ranges on Earth. Now, this thing that's made, which is called water, just happens to have phenomenal characteristics, which you could liken to the Goldilocks zone of what was needed. It's the perfect set of characteristics to do what's needed on Earth, and boy, water does a lot. So, for example, it's got adhesion quality. So when you wash up a cup, you know, or take the pot out of the sink and you've washed it, you'll notice it's still dripping water. Water adheres to surfaces. It's got cohesion. Amazingly enough, millions and millions of these little molecules love to join up with each other, and so you get flowing water. You know, oceans and streams and waterfalls and raindrops and things, they just love that. And it happens to be a liquid at normal pressure, not up on the top of Mount Everest, it's a bit different, but normal pressure and normal temperatures between 0 and 100 degrees, it's a liquid. Unless you boil a jug, you see, and you see what comes out the top, it turns into steam. So that's pretty amazing. But if that doesn't get to you, well, let's look at it a little bit microscopically. So here's the oxygen atom. If we imagine the molecule, there's the two hydrogen atoms. And what does this diagram mean? Well, the 8 plus is talking about the 8 photons, protons. Photons, that's light. Protons. And the 8 in the middle with an N is the 8 neutrons. Now, hydrogen, oddly enough, does not have a neutron. It only has a proton in its nucleus and one electron. Now, it just so happens that these two elements love getting together. Now, it's just as well because hydrogen is a particularly challenging element to sort of live with. We'll just unpack that in a little while. Just think of the Hindenburg disaster while we're getting there. So when you look at the oxygen atom, I don't want you to think, oh, that was easy peasy. It's got two shells. There's an outer shell with 6 electrons and an inner shell with 2. Just happens to have those. But the outer shell is able to share that one electron from the hydrogen atoms just spot on. And the actual angle of these connections just happens to be 104.5 degrees. There's some amazing tetrahedral geometric qualities in the makeup of the way the molecule is structured and the way it connects with other molecules. It's like accident? Chance? This is pretty crazy stuff. Well, let's go a little bit further because it's easy to overlook it. So in order for water to be water, you've got to have these two things that happen to have the right number of electrons, the right characteristics to form a covalent bond. Okay? But oddly enough, oxygen is a diatomic atom in its structure. It has two. It's O2, and hydrogen is diatomic. Water, is its chemical name is H2O, not H2O2, which is hydrogen peroxide, which wouldn't do you any good at all. So when water forms, it has to let go of one of its oxygen atoms. Just happens to do that, you know, by chance, over millions of years. You're right. Now, so I'm just trying to get you wowed with the invisible things, because we get so hoodwinked with, you know, some of the fossil evidence and some of the arguments about evolution, and we forget, hang on a minute, before you even go to animals and bones, let's look at the atoms that make up things, and let's marvel at the creating, the creative power that is evident in these incredible atoms and things. Now, just to make it a bit more relevant to us, these are some stats on what water does for us, okay? So, it's necessary to dissolve minerals. So when you gobble up food and you have all your metabolic processes, it's absolutely vital that every cell, you know, has water. The blood needs water, all the metabolism processes need water, your brain needs water. If you didn't have water, you're pickled. And about 65%, imagine getting a proportion, it's about up to here. Imagine all of that down there happens to be water. Sorry, Alistair, you thought you were pretty special, but actually you're 65% water. And that goes for you guys too. Okay? Unless you had a big drink this morning, it might be a bit more. 65% of you and me is this stuff called water. And it's just right for life. In fact, we would die in a few days without it. Die in a few days without this stuff. Now, what's quite phenomenal is that when you look at the universe per se, the temperatures out there in outer space are not just cold, they're really, really cold. Now, absolute zero is when everything kind of theoretically would stop, everything would just freeze at the subatomic level. They reckon the temperature in outer space is about minus 270 degrees. Now, minus 273 is as low as you can get on the Kelvin scale. Minus 270 is the estimated temperature of stuff out there, not including, obviously, the stars, which would be the opposite end of the scale. It's really, really cold. And then if we take the stars, some of those huge suns that are out there, their temperatures go up into the millions, the tens of millions of degrees. Now, within that huge range of temperature, freezing cold out of space, to these enormous temperatures of the suns, water can only exist as water between 0 degrees Celsius and 100 degrees Celsius in this tiny little temperature band. Now, what it says is that when you think of the whole universe, our Earth is absolutely perfect. It's the perfect zone in terms of its location to our star. The star is the right size for our Earth. Any closer, all the water would evaporate. Any further away, it would turn to ice and it would be hopeless. It's got to be the right size, it's got to be the right distance from us in order for water to be water and liquid as we enjoy it. It's in the Goldilocks zone. The probability of all that happening by chance? Yeah, right. Yes, it looks like there's ice on some of the planets and moons of some of the planets in our solar system, but not liquid water. Not liquid water. It's incredibly rare. They haven't found any liquid water yet, from what I can gather on the internet. Okay. Now, the other fascinating thing is that water has a very amazing capacity to absorb heat, and it takes a lot to lose heat. And so its capacity to absorb heat helps to keep the temperatures on the Earth quite stable. Just happens to have that as well. Yeah, right. It's an incredible substance. The next time you take your cup and pour some water into it, just take a moment to go, wow. Now, I don't want you to get away with this because H2O, hydrogen and oxygen, make up water, but let's go a bit deeper and just learn about oxygen for a moment. Let's learn a bit more. So it's a diatomic element. So it's got two of these oxygen atoms together, and they share a couple of these electrons. So there's two of them. And if we just look at one of them again in a bit more detail, you've got this thing called the nucleus, these two shells with these electrons. Just hang on there, don't lose me on this one. Oxygen is incredibly obviously soluble in water, which is great, and especially for fish and things like that. It's got, just by chance, the second highest electronegativity of all the reactive elements in the element on the periodic table. Now that means it loves, it's the second most amazing element for getting alongside others and forming bonds, you see. It is an incredibly strong oxidizing agent. You know how things rust and things go old. And if that doesn't really get you, I thought you'd love this bit. Now, I wonder what the atomic radius from here to here is of this atom. Just how big is it from one side to the other side, this little thing? Just breathe in, get some into your lungs. Whew, just got some in. So how big were these little things, these little atoms of oxygen that you just breathed in? Well, according to Google, it says they are approximately 60 picometers. Now, you know how we went millimeters, micrometers, nanometers? Picometers is the next one along. It's like 60 times 10 to the minus 12 of a meter. It's like a million. You divide a millimeter by a million. It's like, it's incredibly, incredibly small. Incredibly, incredibly small. Now, if you think that's small, I wonder what the width is here of the nucleus. Now, according to Google, it says they reckon the nucleus distance from there to there is 3 femtometers. So we go millimeters, micrometers, nanometers, picometers, and then femtometers. And there's only 3 of these little femtometers width of the nucleus of an atom. Now, this is mind-boggling stuff. And if you believe in a naturalist, humanist paradigm for explaining the cosmos, the earth, life, and you, you've got to accept that the little tiny subatomic particles that make up oxygen, the nucleus, the atoms, electrons, you've got to accept that they just got there by chance with the right characteristics. Yeah, right. It cries out an intelligent creator of infinitesimal wisdom and power, which, I don't know your name, but...
Bryn.
Yeah, in your verse it said his was inexhaustible. Didn't it use the word inexhaustible? His one... Unfathomable, yeah. Unfathomable. Now, whoever made this thing called an oxygen atom has to be able to see into that stuff and be able to control it. Now, this was pretty exciting stuff. Now, to help the kids at the back, you imagine when you get your pencil and you make a full stop when you're writing, full stop, you go with your pencil. Well, I reckon you could fit 20 million oxygen atoms in one full stop. Just 20 million of them. Whew. Now, they don't travel nicely like you learned at fifth form at high school in a nice little circle. They actually spin around all over the show, but they don't smack into each other. They don't blast apart. Somehow, they're spinning around and I'll get to the speed in my next slide. At a phenomenal speed, something's holding them together. So let's look quickly at hydrogen. Good old hydrogen. Take another breath, because there aren't any hydrogen probably in your breath. Okay? In fact, hydrogen probably wouldn't be very good for you. Now, hydrogen is again a non-toxic, non-metallic, odorless, tasteless, colorless, but it's also a highly combustible gas. Okay? It's also diatomic, so it's got two of these little atoms and can share an electron. Now, this is what it looks like on its lonesome. One little, pity little, lonely electron and one little itty-bitty proton in the middle. No neutron. Now, just give you the size scale. Okay, you take a cent coin. I want you to compare a cent to the size of the moon. Well, that's like comparing this atom to a cent. So you compare this hydrogen atom to a cent coin as a cent coin is to the moon. We're talking about really, 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 really small. Now, it just happens to be the lightest element out of all the elements that we know. Evidently, hydrogen is the most abundant element in the entire universe, but it's almost non-existent in Earth's atmosphere. It's almost non-existent because it's so lightweight, it escapes from the atmosphere. The way it mostly is found is in water, which is bizarre. It's bizarre. And our atmosphere is made up of nitrogen and oxygen, and it's not full of hydrogen like you might suspect. It's like, wow, this is strange. Now, I just want you to think about the speed with which these little electrons are whizzing around the nucleus of this proton. Speed. Here we go. Whew. Evidently, the little lonesome electron is really hyperactive. You thought your kids were hyperactive? You thought sugar makes you active? I tell you, this electron in hydrogen is so hypo, it goes about 2,200 kilometers per second, which works out, according to my calculator, about 7.9 million kilometers per hour. Okay, now just 7.9 million kilometers per hour. So there's a little lonesome proton, and there's one little electron whizzing around, and it's whizzing around at 7.9 million kilometers per hour. At that size, how does it do it? How do you make sense of that speed? Well, it would go around the Earth in about 18 seconds. It's phenomenal what we're dealing with. These microscopic atomic particles cry out intelligent design. They cry out an incredibly powerful God who can hold that energy together. Because we know that when the dirigibles, you know, those airships were in vogue, and one was docking at a place in America and it caught fire, it was full of hydrogen, the thing just boofed into in a huge ball of flames. Hydrogen's an incredibly volatile combustible gas. Something is holding this all together, and it just loves getting alongside oxygen, and the two just love to create water. Isn't that amazing? It's like, whoo! So, back to Genesis. God's word says, and God divided the light. We talked about light, this amazing electromagnetic spectrum, radiation. He divided the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. Now, the Hebrew word yom is a literal 24-hour period. In our last session, we had an affirmation from a Hebrew scholar, but also his arguments were based in the biblical text. That it's incredible. You've got the evening and the morning. You've got numeric qualifiers for each day, the first day, the second day. And the whole of the principle of Shabbat, the seventh day rest that Israel had mentioned in Exodus, is that for as God rested on the seventh day, so the Israelites should have that day of rest accordingly. If God rested for 7 billion years on the seventh day, then it would make an absurdity of the Shabbat principle. People would be expected to rest for 7 million days as well. Yeah, right. So we're talking about the first day. There's the water. There's the Spirit of God moving upon the face of the waters. There's let there be light, and there was light. And we've considered just some of the molecular aspects of hydrogen and oxygen that make up this thing called water. We've talked about the electromagnetic spectrum, and it's like, whoa! It's so easy in those first few verses to overlook the glory of God in what is being declared here. So according to this thing, 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by water. 70%. And one of the big questions you have to ask yourself if you, or ask people who don't share this creation view of the world, is where did the water come from? If God didn't make it, where did the water come from? Where did that water come from? It's an amazing thing. Now, when God says he divided the light from the darkness, it implies that he got the world spinning. Because if you look at this little embedded thing here that shows the spinning of the earth, you can see the light's on my side and it hits darkness as the earth spins around. If you try to imagine, how can you divide light from darkness? As soon as you turn on the light, it triumphs over darkness. But if you have something that's spinning with a light source against it, it actually divides the light from the darkness as it rotates around. So I believe at this outset in Genesis 1, we've got God setting it in motion. Setting it in motion. Now, it may not have been on the angle of the axis that it is now. It may not have been exactly the same speed, but it's, you know that the Earth's slowly spinning slower each time, each year. But we do know that the spin of the Earth is very finely calibrated. It's no joke that it spins at the speed that it does. It's beautifully calibrated to give us a day and a night. And watch out if it slows down too much or if it speeds up. Big trouble. So my question at the bottom is, and it's now a chance for you to talk with each other, is to ask your person next to you, what can we learn about God's character through the things that he has made that we've talked about? I just want to give you 3 or 4 minutes. Have a conversation. All right, folks, let's reconvene for the concluding portion of the teaching this morning. I hope that in your conversation you were able to affirm or agree that this is pretty amazing stuff. And it does, from my worldview perspective, cry out a very, very intelligent and creative supernatural origin to the world that we enjoy. I don't want to be rude or denigrate anyone who may not be in that zone yet, but because I didn't get saved till I was 20. But when I got saved and was born again through faith in the Lord Jesus, I honestly believe it was like I got a new set of eyes. And whereas I didn't see things clearly, suddenly I saw, wow, flowers, leaves, sunsets, birds flying. It was like, wow, it kind of made sense. But I just want to wrap up with 2 slides to address a couple of issues. First of all, it's all very well going to Genesis chapter 1, but what's the application to us as believers in Messiah today? So I think this verse is very powerful. You might like to look it up in your Bibles. It's 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 6. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 6.